Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there a gender bias in science? Women today earn a greater number of college degrees overall than men. Yet as of 2011, those graduates held just over a quarter of all jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math. And as my guest has discovered, the consequences of that imbalance reach far beyond the diminished career prospects of women who wish to work in the sciences. Journalist Marguerite Del Giudice wrote about this recently for National Geographic Online. Her article is called Why It's Crucial to Get More Women into Science. Marguerite, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Do women and men approach science in fundamentally different ways?
Well, I think that men and women, in many ways, there's a lot of overlap in terms of what kinds of traits or attitudes or behaviors just because of shared human experience. But there are ways in which men and women live their lives differently. And in that place where they live their lives differently are opportunities for different perspectives. So you have both the shared experience and then you have the added range that women and other underrepresented groups can bring to scientific inquiry.
The gap in the sciences is most evident in the more math-intensive fields like computer science and engineering. What does that suggest about the nature of this problem? In other words, is there a reason? Is that because fewer women are being steered into higher order math?
Well, if you're trying to get at the whys of all of this, I mean, it's very hard to point to any one thing as the cause of slower progress for women. It's a confluence of factors that involve a lot of cultural traditions and personal choices and the biological differences between the sexes that, you know, place the burden of parenthood disproportionately on women, even if both spouses work full time. And those, they're very powerful forces and traditions, and they die hard.
Well, let's talk about why it should matter to all of us if women are underrepresented in STEM fields. For one thing, there is evidence that we have missed a lot of cases of things like heart disease in women because for a long time it was studied almost exclusively in men.
Well, that has been the model in science, has been the average white male. And I don't think anyone intended this. This is not deliberate. It's just it's an ingrained traditional procedural bias based on the presumption that, you know, men could predict all of human experience. And it was just a blind spot. And so if you, it, you know, there were... you know, issues having to do with, say, gendered interventions, which is a new project. It's not a new project. It's been around for a long time. It's an international collaborative involving the European Commission and the National Science Foundation and Stanford University. And their idea is to try to harness creative power and the creative power of sex and gender to discover new things. So, for instance, not just with heart disease and women, say medications that were tested on men because, you know, women weren't in the clinical trials and it was later discovered that the dosages were too high. Just last year, women were advised to cut their dosage of Ambien in half. But it's not just for women. It's for all of societies. So, for instance, say osteoporosis in men, which is a disease that's traditionally been thought of as a female disease of postmenopausal women. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, women have been the study group, but it's led to an unconscious gender bias that shaped how the disease is screened and treated. So if a male goes through a bone scanner that's calibrated to evaluate women, you wouldn't see the disease because the bones of males are heavier and more robust. But you have men that have hip fractures after the age of 75, and they're dying more often for reasons no one really knows yet. So here's you're overlooking a huge population that's not getting proper treatment.
I was surprised to read that even lab animals historically have been more likely to be male than female.
Well, that's true. Again, it's another blind spot. It's just how things have always been done. And just recently, the National Institutes of Health, just this year, has said, well, it's now going to be a requirement. You know, any research we fund has to include, where it's appropriate, female animals and female tissues and female cells. It's just not been done before. It's just this unconscious it's the unconsciousness of it, of the gender bias, that I think is the major thing that holds progress back, the forces that guide decisions in ways that we're largely unaware of.
How do male-dominated research teams affect the development even of, you know, consumer products that are meant to be unisex?
Well, it's only because they can't help but look at things in a gendered way. So that, you know, for instance, when it comes to inventions, women have invented a lot of things that were related to home and hearth over the years. Disposable diapers, foldable cribs, I think the foot pedal trash can, things like that. They've also, you know, invented the circular saw. They've invented Nystatin, which I think was the first successful fungus-fighting drug, and also Kevlar. So it's not that men or women cannot invent anything. It's just that if a team is male-dominated, things might not occur to them. So that in engineering, as someone I spoke to was talking to me about the creation of smart houses, of you know, you turn your heat on, you turn your lights on, you have security. It's all about control. Where a woman, you know, might like to, can somebody work on a house that that can clean itself?
Right.
It's not that a man can't invent that thing, but it just might not occur to him. And or if it does occur to him, it's not going to be high on the list. So ideally what you want on these teams, and teams are now the foundation of science research. It's no longer a solo genius making a discovery that changes the world. You know, they're teams. And what you want on the teams, ideally, are, you know, smart, capable people with range, with a range of perspective. So, and it's something that, you know, it goes beyond social justice, although social justice is important. But, you know, our population is growing more and more diverse every year. You know, I came across an article in the Deloitte Review, which is a journal for business leaders. And it talked about the move from the arc of women coming into science, the importance of social justice, and this having actually to do with diversity of all kinds. You know, having more women in science, you can't separate out other underrepresented groups. They're part of a movement toward diversity. And diversity is starting to make market sense. So in this article, they talked about our population is growing more and more diverse every year. And smart companies, they quoted executives from Kellogg and Jamba Juice, I believe, saying that, you know, smart companies are trying to create genuinely inclusive environments that look at diversity as an asset. The idea being that if the workforce or the team that you have that's addressing problems or trying to create things is representative of the population in some way, then it stands to reason that they're going to have a greater chance of seeing things that other people in the industry don't see, which is going to lead to a kind of increased resonance with new consumers or with consumers and presumably higher profits.
I was thinking about this after reading your article, the fact that, you know, the new smartphones are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and plenty of women have them just as plenty of men do. But I don't particularly want one because it's a little big for my hand. And frankly, it's a little big for most of my purses, which is something that it seems like a female engineer might be more aware of.
Well, that's probably true. And again, I think it's not an either or kind of thing, but it's just what you're saying. You know, it's what's going to occur to someone. You have fewer blind spots. The more range that you have, the more different perspectives, understandings, tricks, things that people bring with them from their life experience is only going to expand the range of possibility. And, you know, you can, if you have a team that's composed in that way, you know, the bag of tricks you can call on is enormous, and the possibility for real innovation just increases.
You have an interesting bit in the piece about people considering public transit and planning for that. And the needs of different people vary. Not everyone is on the sort of standard 9-to-5 schedule. And that's something that might not occur to everyone on a team.
Well, it's not a standard category of analysis. And what we're talking about is something that was something that's called the mobility of care. So you have people who are doing caring work with children, with elderly people. So, and you know, women are still bearing the lion's share of responsibility for child care, for elder care, and for household responsibilities, even if both spouses work full time. And it happens with scientists that a significant number, a significant percentage of female scientists are married to other scientists. But, when engineers, civil engineers, do an analysis of how people travel, they tend to think in terms of work and coming back from work. But, if you take someone, it doesn't have to be a woman, of course, but anyone whose day also includes dropping their child off at daycare, then going to work, then after work going to the dry cleaners, and then maybe food shopping, then daycare and going home. That's just, it's not thought of. No one is trying to discriminate against anyone. It just isn't occurring to them.
What's interesting about that is that even as gender roles get more egalitarian, you're still going to have more men who have those needs. It's not even simply something that is sort of left for women to take care of in these kinds of considerations.
I'm not sure I understand what you mean. That there are going to be more men who
These days, it's mostly it's still probably more women who are taking care of small children and dropping off at daycare and doing the food shopping. But it seems that this generation of young men today is doing more of that sort of thing than they ever did before.
Absolutely. There's no question that there's a generational shift occurring, and men are more and more interested in being involved with their families. Absolutely. So, yeah, there would be an increase. Absolutely. That's the direction things are moving in. But I would say right now it still affects more women than men. But it doesn't matter. It's whomever is doing that work would benefit, from a transit system that took that into account.
So women are about half the population of Internet users. Why are there so few women coders?
Why? Well,
What did you learn about that?
Yeah, because this is one of the things that someone said to me is that, there just aren't very many women there in some of the fields, in some of the engineering fields and in computer science. The number of women is very few. And so, it can be difficult to enter a workforce if you're going to be maybe the only woman or one of a few women. It's uncomfortable. Someone mentioned to me that when a critical mass is met, and the figure that was thrown out was, say, 30%, that once 30% of an office or a team or any group, becomes women, say, they stop being seen as women and they start being seen as coworkers or people who are African-American and any social identity. But there needs to be a critical mass. So that's one factor. The other factor is that it has Silicon Valley has an image of being a very intense so-called bro coding culture where you're expected to be working even when you're not working. And it may, that may or may not be fair or true. And my understanding is that a lot of money is being spent in Silicon Valley to try to attract more women and other underrepresented groups. But for as long as there is that image, it's not that attractive. And if you are a woman, you do have the option of having a child. And if you're serious about having a family, that can be even more off-putting. In engineering and computer science, as I understand it, they're very fast-moving fields. And so if you leave, you can really fall behind quicker in those fields. And, so those are some of the factors why they're aren't as many women in computer science and engineering. And also, if you're also good at other things, if you can go into law and work to in any area that you're interested in, and maybe make a difference socially, rather than sit in a room all day and code, that might also be more attractive. The personal choice is also an aspect of this. What's the quality of life?
We're speaking this hour with journalist Marguerite Del Giudice. Her article for National Geographic is called Why It's Crucial to Get More Women into Science. We'd love to hear from you now. If you are a scientist, if you have a daughter in the sciences, or if you are simply considering what this all means to our society, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Marguerite Del Giudice. She has an article for National Geographic currently online called Why It's Crucial to Get More Women into Science. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Marguerite, certainly there are lots of efforts in schools and at the university level to encourage young women who are interested in the sciences. Did you hear from people who have been exposed to these programs about how well they work and how they might be adjusted, not only to recruit women, but a very diverse scientific population?
Well, my understanding of, is that a lot of money has been spent a lot of effort and continues to go on by government and the business world to attract different women into science and to keep them there. There are more and more institutions offer flex schedules. Universities offer tenure delays. All kinds of programs are more and more in the offing. What someone at the National Science Foundation told me is that what they're finding, though, is that often the programs are available, and women and men too, because they are often available to men as well, are reluctant to, in some cases, take advantage of them. Because while the climates vary from workplace to workplace, university to university, they can feel stigmatized or in any number of ways made to feel that maybe they're not being serious about science. So part of what has to happen, as it's been explained to me, is for there to be a real buy-in to the idea of having diversity of all kinds and women in the workforce. There's a program at the National Science Foundation called the ADVANCE program. Mm-hmm. It's run by a woman named Beth Michnick. And, it promotes women in academic STEM and also institutional transformation. And one of the programs, the whole idea of unconscious bias over and over again came up as this is the major problem that holds everyone up. And you need to create a real sense of wanting to embrace a more diverse workforce and understanding that there are assets and understanding the kinds of unconscious things that are at play when women apply for jobs. You know, letters of recommendation are written differently for women than for men. There's a famous study out of Yale last year, and I think it was done many years ago, the John and Jennifer study. You may have heard of it, or your listeners may have heard of it, where, I think 127 resumes were sent out for a lab managing position. And everything in the resumes was exactly the same, except for the names. You know, half of them were John and half of them were Jennifer. And the people who evaluated them were asked to, evaluate their competency. What would they pay them? Would they be willing to mentor them? And, what was found was that men were preferred. They were offered more money. And they were the evaluators were more willing to mentor them.
Wow.
And what was interesting about this, too, is that these evaluations were, the gender bias was practiced equally by women as by men. So it's completely unconscious. So when you the interesting thing is that they, I think, deliberately incorporated some subtlety into the study so that they weren't offering a stellar candidate. My understanding is that, whenever there's a stellar candidate, probably in any field, whether it's a man or a woman or any other kind of underrepresented group, if the person's stellar, those factors don't come into play nearly as much. But of course, most people in the field they're not at the top ends of the field. They're in that middle group.
Yeah, solid but imperfect. Right.
Yeah, solid but imperfect. So the more that it's found that the more that people have to think about, do I want this person? The more these unconscious gender biases come into play. And, you know, they're very powerfully knitted together. And I learned a lot myself, and my own consciousness was raised. But, you know, the underpinnings of this go all the way back to, Aristotle, who espoused an inherent inferiority of women. And, that was influenced Western thought for hundreds and thousands of years. And it's a very toxic part of the legacy that's still very much alive today. And the thing about it is we're all born into the same culture, men and women. And everyone to some degree buys into it. So men are under a tremendous amount of pressure to make their mark in the public sphere. And women are under a kind of pressure to take on more supportive roles. And this, of course, varies. I'm speaking with a very broad brush here.
Mm-hmm.
To take on more supportive roles and maintain a stable family life. And these things are still operating unconsciously. So there was all of the social science literature going back to the 1990s validates this. It validates the ideas that, women are thought by men and women. Their work is undervalued and men's work is overvalued. Women tend to be less confident. And there was a cover story in the Atlantic Monthly this year. I think it was called The Confidence Gap. Women demonstrate less confidence even if they have greater skill. But men will tend to have more swagger. And there was a woman at Penn that I spoke to. She's a psychological researcher. And she said, she's a very extremely successful woman with, every medal imaginable on her breast. But she says when she sends out a peer review article, and, it's done collaboratively, and if it comes back with suggestions or, criticisms, her first thought is, maybe they're right. I should have done that. And she said to a man, the male first reaction is idiots, those jerks.
Right.
In her experience, there's a lot of overlap in terms of the traits of men and women because of their shared human experiences. But there are differences as well for whatever reason, in terms of how women are socialized. So in a group setting, she said, her experience is that, men will be more likely to kind of grab for the ring. They'll be more likely to seize an opportunity, sometimes recklessly, and overreact in that sense. And women will tend to be, more thoughtful and think things through. And if you think of this in terms of a team, then that becomes a very good team. You want both of those aspects on your team. And that's not to say, again, that there aren't shared behaviors, that there aren't women who aren't very assertive in that way, or, men who don't have don't tend toward being self-examining. But in general, what happens is that you get to increase that range if both are there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Amanda in Dallas. Hello, Amanda.
Hello. Thank you for having me. So I have a question for your guest, and I was wondering if maybe the society's emphasis on a woman's look, maybe it discourages women from entering certain fields like the sciences because they feel like their assets of their looks won't be as utilized versus like sales or marketing.
You mean women who want to, say, dress a certain way and wear high heels might not feel comfortable doing that in science?
No, I was more saying that women are brought up to think that their looks are really important. And if they are in a cubicle all day doing coding, maybe they feel like their assets, which they believe are their looks, aren't being utilized. Does that make sense?
And you think that this would you mean that you think women are socialized to want to use those looks to their advantage, that if they can't?
Yeah, I think that's what she's saying. Somehow that they're encouraged to look first to their looks and then to their intelligence.
I'm afraid I can't speak intelligently to that. I mean, I'm sure there are some women who feel that way, or especially I think, if you're blessed with good looks, male or female, that's going to tend to work to your advantage. But I don't know that it's a disadvantage not to use them, but I can't speak to how women might feel about that. I'm afraid I don't know.
Have you come across in your research any really good examples of mentoring that would really be helpful for not just women, but also people of color and people from the LGBT community and whoever else would make a team particularly diverse and more than just white men? Are there particularly good efforts out there that you know of?
Well, I think that there are. Again, the advanced program at the National Science Foundation is always trying to work on these things and offer professional services and professional development and to support women and kind of understanding how to manage their career, because a lot of that information, and again, this is not deliberate, it's just how things were. It's tradition. A lot of information about how to manage one's career, a lot of mentoring happens very informally. And women are often left out of that conversation, perhaps not deliberately, or don't know how to get into that conversation. And, you know, they can use help, particularly young women, you know, learning how to ask for help, learning how to ask for questions, learning how to ask questions, rather, about what's going to count in terms of a promotion. You know, sometimes if there's a program in place, a diversity program in place, and somebody's coming to take a look at the workplace, they want to make sure that one of the two women in that group is present. But she's not necessarily going to get any credit for that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to David in North Richland Hills. Hi, David.
Hi. So I'm actually a adjunct professor at Tarrant County College in the sciences, and I see the role of young women as they're coming up in science a lot. But one of the things I wanted to comment was when I was a young graduate student, the work-life balance that was expected of both the men and the women was very, very made it very, very difficult to have any sort of thought about raising a family or any of these kind of things for both men and women. And, you know, this was 10, 15 years ago, of course, and attitudes definitely have changed, but it was there was a lot of resistance from the part of the older scientists for the women that were in my graduate school cohort, as well as those of us who were more interested as men in not spending 90 hours a week in the lab and things of this nature and having a life outside of our graduate studies. And I could definitely see the problems that this occurred both for both the men and the women. I mean, this is an ongoing problem in the sciences.
That's really interesting. Is there anything that you heard there that you'd like to comment on, Marguerite?
As I said before, there is, you know, more and more men genuinely want to get involved with their children. And, you know, addressing issues of life balance is huge for everyone, really, across the professions. I know when I was talking to people, and I would, you know, the whole issue of the biological differences between men and women is huge, and really how to manage that in a way that makes sense and that does not have a negative impact only on the career of the woman, because that's just, you know, what happens. And what someone said to me is, please don't cast it as a motherhood issue. It's a parenthood issue. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of truly valuing parenthood and the idea of, you know, both parents being equally involved, you know, in other cultures and, you know, the idea of having widespread provision of quality health care, making sure that people don't feel stigmatized if they take those tenure delays or flex schedules. In Sweden and Norway, there are long leaves that are paid for fathers and mothers. And I believe that the fathers are required to take those leaves in some other cultures. So, you know, that's just in other parts of the world. It's not the United States. But to think about how to structure jobs in a way that having a child doesn't have such a negative effect on the career of the woman, to think about on-ramps and off-ramps, as someone put it, to think consciously about it rather than just to allow things to float along, because they'll just tend to continue as they are.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Elizabeth in Dallas. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I was wondering, do you think teachers push boys toward science more than they push girls, or is there any factor there that, you know, that you've looked at for early education?
Hello?
Yes, we're here.
Well, that's one, you know, it's one of the factors of, you know, the whys, you know, various ways that girls are steered, you know, away from science. And often it's very subtle, even though there are efforts to include them. You know, again, it's these really silent and powerful social forces that mostly, you know, we're not aware of. So, you know, for instance, when I, and this had to do with my parents, but it would have been in schools too. You know, when I was a child, I really wanted this dissecting kit that was for sale at a place called Schnippers, and where I grew up in North Jersey. And for months, and in my mind, I think it was even years, I just lusted after it. It was, you know, like a frog and a fish or something else in formaldehyde. And I think all my parents could imagine was that I'd be at their kitchen table doing this. And, you know, they just never took it seriously. I later realized I had a real passion there. But it just wasn't recognized. And I was a child. I didn't know enough to advocate for myself. In a more general sense, you know, women tend to be steered away from professions involving, you know, prestige and money. What's happening in science is happening, you know, across the professions, maybe to a greater degree in science in certain fields. But it's, you know, it's a societal issue. So, again, when I was growing up, I wasn't necessarily going to go to college. I wasn't on a college track. I was placed in a business program because that's what all of the bright Italian girls did where I grew up. They became executive secretaries. And, you know, had it not been for, you know, an English teacher who saw something in me and said, why aren't you going to college? I probably wouldn't have gone to college. So there are things as subtle and simple as that that can make a huge difference.
On both sides, positive and negative, I guess.
Yes.
My guest is journalist Marguerite Del Giudice. Her article for National Geographic is called Why It's Crucial to Get More Women into Science. We have lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Marguerite Del Giudice. Her article for the current National Geographic is online. It's called Why It's Crucial to Get More Women into Science. You can weigh in on this at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Zach, who says, one thing I'd like to point out is that women saturate one of the largest science-driven careers in our country, nursing, and they succeed and dominate at all levels of administration in the hospital setting. So I guess, Marguerite, there are certainly some bright spots out there.
Oh, I don't think there's any question that there's been a tremendous amount of progress. You know, I would also say that while they dominate in administration, you know, and I don't know, maybe you're the person who emailed you does, how many women are actually running hospitals, how many women are actually in positions of leadership. I mean, they're currently very well represented in you know, psychology, psychiatry, and in medicine, but not in positions of leadership. And, you know, that's where a real difference comes about. I know that in some of the diversity programs that are in place, what's been found is that, you know, people will they'll check all the right boxes. They know they have to have a woman on the search committee or an African-American. That doesn't mean there's real buy-in. And what they find is that there's not necessarily a real difference in outcome in terms of who gets offered jobs, say, unless there is that person is leading the inquiry or is leading the committee. You know, one of the things, a program like, again, it's this gender bias that's gone underground that is at the heart of slowing down the progress. And there is a program at the University of Michigan, you know, getting them into science, getting women into science at this point, or any social identity that's underrepresented, really has to do with changing how people actually think and creating environments in which women are actually genuinely accepted. And the University of Michigan had a program called STRIDE, which was funded by the National Science Foundation's advanced program. And it wasn't just a consciousness-raising program. And as a result, they were able to, in their schools of science and engineering, they overcame gender bias and increased the proportion of well-qualified women that they hired by 30% each year over 9 years. And it wasn't quota filling, you know, which can have mixed results and breed resentment. It was about creating buy-in. And like, how do you create buy-in? How do you speed up people's awareness? And how they did it was through this program, STRIDE, and Advance funded it, and senior faculty in the schools of science and engineering were actually paid and given the time to study the extensive social science data on the many forms that gender bias can take in recruiting and hiring and promotion. And then these scientists would make presentations to their colleagues. And, you know, it became much more credible because it was coming from colleagues. It was coming from a peer. It wasn't coming from a social scientist. And it wasn't just stories or anecdotes. It was actually data about how bias actually works in institutions in ways that can actually be identified and fixed. So some of the things that I may have mentioned, like letters of recommendation written differently for women than for men, and realizing that that's happening. Men being preferred over women and deemed more competent and worthy of higher pay, even when the credentials are identical. The fact that women have been found to be disliked for their accomplishments and abilities. And this, again, is among men and women. And tend to demonstrate, you know, less confidence. And then when you add all of the factors involving parenthood and, you know, leaves to have a child, you know, at the end of the day, women just, you know, leak. It's called the leaky pipeline. They just leak out. So what they did at the University of Michigan is, you know, they had scientists study the social science literature, make presentations to their colleagues, and then it was integrated into the hiring process. And you know, it was a huge success, and it's become a model, and it's adaptable to any setting. You know, you can do it in a business setting. You could do it anywhere. Right now, it's being replicated at Northeastern University and Purdue and I think Grand Valley State and others, you know. So, and it's also been found that when an institution is made more welcoming to women or, again, any other traditionally underrepresented group, mm-hmm. then it becomes more welcoming to everyone. It's not just good for women. It's good for everyone.
Yeah. How are those letters of recommendation different specifically, by the way? That's very interesting to me.
I know. And, you know, it's the use of words. You know, I don't have a specific. I wish I had one in front of me that I'd read.
Sort of highlighting different skills and strengths, that sort of thing?
Different skills or you know, men would be described in more action-oriented words. Mm-hmm. And women are, you know, more likable, more reliable.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like a big difference, but if you're looking to hire someone with qualities, you might go for, you know, the one that appears likely to give you more for your hiring dollar.
It's very subjective, mm-hmm. you know. There was a guy that I talked to in Norway. His name is Kurt Rice, and he runs Norway's Committee on Gender Balance and Research. And he was talking about how, you know, he didn't know, and really he was not aware of and these kinds of disparities. And when he became a manager at the university, I think he's at the University of Tromsø. I probably butchered that.
I wouldn't know, but, so it's okay.
Yeah. He was interested in issues of leadership, and he wanted to make the workplace better. And he had just assumed by making the workplace better that it would automatically be better for women. And he said he realized that he found himself always turning to the women to ask them to do the extra work, the administrative tasks, write this report, all of this extra stuff, because they would tend to say yes. And men had no trouble saying, no, I'm too busy with something else. And the women would end up working longer hours. And he said, and they were less likely to promote themselves. And of course, again, there's that unspoken, there's that way that information gets transferred informally. So if you have a workplace that's dominated by males and historically created by males, you know, until you have a critical mass of females there, it's going to operate the way it's always operated. And women have to learn to ask for help and ask for support and manage their careers more assertively, even if they might not be liked for that. Mm-hmm. They might not be liked for their accomplishments and for speaking out and being direct. But what he said is that he ended up attending some gender conference somewhere and listening to some of the things I've talked about today there in the social science research, and it just woke him up. And he realized that, you know, he had just been blind to everything. And he was a very well-meaning person, and most people are. And people, more and more, they don't want to discriminate. They're not trying to do this, men or women. And so he just became, you know, much more conscious of how he managed people. And then he came to the conclusion that, unlike what he had thought before, which is if you improve the workplace, you will improve it for women. But that if you improve the workplace for women, you really are going to improve it for everyone.
We have an email here from Elizabeth in Fort Worth who writes, when my husband was in graduate school in organic chemistry, a fellow student got pregnant. As it happened, her research subject involved chemicals that were extremely dangerous to a fetus. She wasn't even able to go into the lab. What was so exasperating was that there didn't seem to be any way to change her subject or delay her work. She would have lost almost a year between pregnancy and any maternity time she took. She basically quit and left the program with a master's degree. And Elizabeth says, I also had a baby in graduate school, but in the humanities, it was relatively easy to take a semester off and return back to the work she was doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just an example of, you know, their unique circumstances. And it's not the same everywhere. And, you know, I'm not sure what one would do in a circumstance like that. You know, one of the women I spoke to, Sue Rosser, who's a provost at San Francisco State University and for academic affairs. And she's also a gender studies professor. And she spoke about when she was, you know, coming up in the 60s, and she was supposed to do graduate or postgraduate work in Africa, involving fossils, and she got pregnant, and she told her advisor that she was pregnant, you know, and he didn't say much to her, but there was some sort of a break, you know, school break, and when she came back, he said, "Okay, well, here's what you're going to do. You're going to go study fossils in the Badlands." And she was like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you can't go to Africa. You're pregnant. You know, it's not safe, and blah blah blah." So she said, "You know, maybe he was right." Maybe, you know, and she said, and her career worked out, you know, fabulously, but she didn't get to choose her topic. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't even included in the conversation.
Yeah.
So it's that unconsciousness. Here he was very well-meaning. And she said he may have been right. But, you know, the feeling of being basically isolated and not part of the decision making about your own life is still goes on to some extent.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Lauren on the line in Dallas. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two comments. First of all, I think that for young girls, if they understood more of the reality of science, how interdisciplinary it is and how much collaboration there is and how much communication and storytelling and more of the whole process, that might attract more young girls. And then second of all, I left a very high-profile science PhD program. And in fact, all the women in my cohort left. It was all because relationship issues just wound up playing the trump card. You know, it's a long-term commitment. You're looking at doing the PhD and then a postdoc. And if you have a husband or a boyfriend whose career moves him to another city, that's a big problem. So I'm interested to hear what you have to say about both of those.
Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, I did hear a lot about the particularly punishing nature of the tenure track, and that it becomes almost impossible to figure out how to manage it. I mean, other professional training paths might be similar, but the academic track appears to be particularly brutal, and I haven't gotten a satisfying answer for why it has to be that way. But it's a really long runway. So you have 4 years of college, you work for some lab for a couple of years, and maybe 5 years getting a PhD, and 3 years getting a postdoc, and then hopefully you're on a tenure track. And all of this is usually occurring during, you know, the beginning of childbearing years, and then you start in the tenure track about 30, when a lot of women want to have their first child these days. And, you know, it's a time of life, as it's been described to me, that's riddled with insecurity, and literally a clock is ticking on many levels. And you're supposed to demonstrate work that's sufficient in quantity and quality so the institution can never fire you. And the pressure is tremendous. So, and, you're dealing with the question of during that time, do I want to have a baby? And most universities have maternal and paternal policies that are accommodating more and more. And you can have 6 months off or add a year to the tenure clock. But you don't raise a child in a year. You know, having a child changes your life. Your time's no longer your own. And I came across somebody told me there's an expression called having your tenure baby, getting pregnant after you get tenure.
Right.
So it's just an extraordinarily difficult position for the person to be in, for both parents, but particularly the woman. You know, how is she going to get these three top-tier publications this year and this grant? And what's her decision-making logic? I can barely get done what I'm getting done now and then raise a child, part-time. So, again, it comes down to, cultural issues. In other cultures, there's quality health care. Men are a little bit ahead of the curve of many men in the United States, although everything is moving in that direction. And it has to come down to jobs being structured in a way that they only affect the woman's career negatively. And, I'm not saying I have answers, but to actually address, well, how can we do this to the degree that people are willing to take advantage of programs that are increasingly available? What can be done to keep them where they are and to be able to tap their talents? Because as a society, we're losing a tremendous amount, when you don't have, when you're not tapping the complete talent force, the human capital available to you, particularly at a time in the world when science and technology are transforming the world with what seems at times to be an alarming scope and speed. You want to have women involved, and so it just has to be addressed in a direct and sincere way, rather than just saying, "Well, women leave because she chooses to have a child," and sometimes that's the case. But it's much more complicated than that and layered. So the more that it's really addressed in a sincere way, with the idea that we're really losing out here for those women who might want to continue their careers and have a lot to offer, maybe you've got to come up with a new way. And the other part of it in terms of getting, more women involved is I think the caller mentioned something about girls being exposed to, what science really involves. And I think there really is much more of that, more and more of that. I can hear the music, so.
I'm going to jump in here. Yes, the article by journalist Marguerite Del Giudice is called Why It's Crucial to Get More Women into Science. You can find it online at National Geographic. Marguerite, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Well, you're welcome.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.